Frederick Malek, chosen recently by George Bush as a key GOP campaign official, compiled figures in 1971 on the number of Jewish officials in the Bureau of Labor Statistics at then President Nixon's request. According to notes taken by White House aides, Nixon had ordered Malek to investigate, quote, a Jewish cabal at the agency. At the time, Malek was Nixon's White House personnel chief and had been assigned to evaluate the BLS staff. On July 27th of 1971, Malek reported to H.R. Haldeman, Nixon's chief of staff, that 13 of 35 top BLS officials were Jewish, according to a memo found last week in the archives from Nixon's presidency. Less than 2 months after Malek's memo, two senior BLS officials who are Jewish were ousted from their posts and moved to less visible positions in the Labor Department agency. They were Peter Henley, H-E-N-L-E, chief economist for BLS, and Harold Goldstein, the director of current employment analysis. Records in the Nixon archives show that 134 documents have been withdrawn from Malek's White House... Oops, let's see here, find the inside part of the article. Got it. Try this one more time. Excuse me here. Records of the Nixon archives show that 134 documents have been withdrawn from Malek's White House files by Nixon's lawyers, who asserted that their release could involve invasion of privacy or violation of other rights. Though an extremely ironic statement in light of the investigation of Jews and subsequent the number of Jews in the Bureau of Labor Statistics and subsequent removal by two of them. Note that Malek apparently held a position analogous. In fact, it might be the exact same position that Helena von Dahn had in charge of personnel for the White House, worth bearing in mind here. Continuing with the article, dozens of other documents filed in the Nixon archives authored by Malek or directed to him also have been withdrawn by Nixon's lawyers. One knowledgeable source said Nixon's representatives carefully went through the files of former Nixon aides who have played or are playing roles in the Bush campaign. Bush picked Malek to manage the Republican National Convention in August and later selected him as deputy chairman of the Republican National Committee with day-to-day responsibility for the party's fall campaign. Malek said Friday that he recalled the incident and had gathered the statistics, quote, but in no way did I take part in moving anyone out of the BLS, unquote. Allegations of anti-Semitism became an issue for the Bush campaign last week after a Jewish newspaper charged that several members of a Bush advisory committee on ethnic issues had passed affiliations that appeared anti-Jewish. Interrupting here, notice the watering down in the language there. A Jewish newspaper charged that several members of a Bush advisory committee on ethnic issues had passed affiliations that appeared anti-Jewish. These guys were bloody fascists who had participated in the Final Solution, among other things, as documented in the current book, Blowback. But I guess...
There is a certain appearance of anti-Semitism to that, I suppose.
Yeah, I suppose slaughtering millions of Jews is certainly that. That has the appearance of anti-Semitism. But it is interesting that now it's the statement is portrayed as a charge by a Jewish newspaper, which subtly makes it sound as though this was some sort of, you know, Zionist vendetta or something, instead of simply a matter of recorded historical fact. It's also interesting, too, that Malek says he did gather the statistics but played no role in the removal of these two officials. That it reminds me in some ways of the people that gathered statistics on the number of Jews in a given village but played no role in the Holocaust. You know, when those same Jews were then rounded up, on the basis of the information that they had provided to the Germans. It's very, very similar kind of rationalization.
Malek might even have said that he was only taking orders.
Skipping down in the article, in 1971, Nixon thought BLS officials were twisting unemployment data to put his administration in an unfavorable light, according to Malek and memos and notes of meetings filed in the Nixon Presidential Archives in Alexandria, Virginia. In a telephone interview, Malek said he studied the matter and found the BLS procedures normal, but Nixon persisted. In at least five White House meetings in July of 1971, Haldeman handwritten notes showed that the president ordered Malek to ascertain the number of Jews in the top ranks of the BLS. Those notes were discovered last spring in a review of unindexed Nixon files for a series of articles on Bush. On July 5th of 1971, the notes say, quote, Malek, really check out Jewish cabals, unquote. The July 9th, 1971 notes say, quote, Malek, Jews in BLS, etc., unquote. On July 24th of 1971, how many Jews, Malek, unquote. On July 25th, 1971, Malek, get the number of, of Jews in BLS, unquote, and on July 30th, 1971, where are the figs on BLS ethnics, unquote. According to archivists working on the Nixon papers, these are typical of notations Haldeman made in recording instructions from Nixon. White House aide John Ehrlichman's notes of the July 24th, 1971 meeting under the topic of the BLS say, quote, Malek, a Jew cabal, and then they only talk to Jews, unquote. And so the notion that the Bureau of Labor Statistics was engaged in a Jewish-inspired cabal to portray the Nixon administration in an unfavorable light is worth bearing in mind. And again, when we see Richard Nixon inviting people like Iron Guardist Valerian Trifa to give the opening prayer before the U.S. Senate in 1955, when we see him freely associating with Nikolai Maloxa and using, I believe it was American Tube, as a front, or using his law office as a front for Nikolai Maloxa's American Tube business, and when we see him associating with Ivan Dochev and inviting and attending a prayer breakfast with him, it should not come as that much of a surprise to see these kinds of attitudes reflect. And I recall we're talking about the President of the United States, and Malek, again, holding the same position for Nixon that Helena von Damm apparently held for Ronald Reagan. And it's worth bearing in mind. And again, bearing in mind what we talked about earlier in the program, this is a very good opportunity for people to point out some of these connections to people who might be skeptical. That September 9th article from the New York Times and Blowback being a very fortuitous coincidence here, the fact that the two should come out at the same time, and coordinate that with today's San Jose Mercury as well.
Yeah, Protocols of the Elders of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. One last thing before we take a break. Again, just to point this up, we talk about these things at great length, but it's right here, folks. I mean, it is right here. You've got the whole, you know, anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations is scattered all through the Bush campaign. You know, we're essentially talking about, as Dave mentioned, you know, concentration camp guards, right? We're talking about people who have murdered or been involved in the murder of or wholeheartedly supported the murder of millions of individuals, not just Jews, of course, other ethnic groups as well, and other people of various sexual persuasions and political persuasions as well. We're talking about the worst, ugliest kind of human life ever spawned, and they're playing a prominent role in a presidential campaign. And they've played a prominent role in the presidential, the White House of the last 8 years. And the only thing I want to ask again before we take this break is, come the middle of November, you know, when the papers are running all the postmortems on the campaigns and, the next president is beginning to think about, his transition team and things like that, how are you going to feel? Are you going to feel like you did your best? You know, are you going to feel content that you took your best shot in the two short months that remain? To make some impact on this still somewhat democratic system? Think about it.
You know, one of the things we're always encouraging people to do is to communicate this information. Copy tapes, send them to other people. Each individual can become their own tape duplication service with the tape duplication technology that's available. Also calling other radio stations, calling talk shows and other radio stations, writing letters to the editors of newspapers, writing letters to their congressmen. People might want to take the article from the New York Times and the current book Blowback and maybe write a letter to the editors of the Mercury concerning the Malek situation. Point out that this type of activity shouldn't be all that surprising. People also might want to call up radio stations and call up talk shows on KGO and talk about the New York Times article, talk about the current book Blowback. This is really a great opportunity to score some points if people decide to do something about it.
Yeah, and again, lest you think that as far as the election goes that you may not have much personal impact, consider this. We're probably going to have the closest presidential election since 1968. But we're probably going to have a very close presidential election. California has 47 electoral votes. It's by far the biggest electoral prize. At the moment, it is up for grabs, folks. Radio stations, as Dave mentioned, go a long ways. KGO goes up and down San Francisco, as does up and down California, rather, as does KNBR and a number of other stations. Newspapers, there are only four or five real major newspapers in California, and most of them accept out-of-town letters. Think about it, folks. We got 2 months to go. Where do you want to be in the middle of November, and what kind of a conscience do you want to have?
Again, the New York Times article, all the papers just about had information about the dismissal of those aides, but only the New York Times article that I saw, anyway, mentioned the Phil Guarino connection, but equating blowback. And this book has had national media attention. It's been reviewed in most of the local papers. This is a great opportunity to score some points. Very, very good opportunity to score points.
This is an article from the San Francisco Examiner from last week's Sunday, September 4th, 1988 edition. The article is headlined, Iran-Contra Figure Paid for Quail AIDS Central American Trip. The article subheaded, VP Candidate Says He Wasn't Involved. The article is by Stuart M. Powell and Mike Connolly of the Examiner's Washington Bureau. An aide to Indiana Senator and Republican Vice Presidential Candidate Dan Quayle traveled to Central America in 1983 on a, quote, fact-finding mission, partially financed by a key figure in the Iran-Contra affair. While serving as Quayle's legislative aide for foreign policy, Rob Owen received his first glimpse of the Reagan administration's efforts to secretly resupply U.S.-backed rebels in Nicaragua. On a trip financed in part by John Hull, an American from Indiana whose farm in Costa Rica served as a drop site for the CIA. We should also mention, for those of you out there who may be new listeners to the show, this is obviously a parenthetical insertion here, John Hull has not only been involved with the dropping of weapons, but according to many sources, John Hull's ranch was also a transshipment point for Medellin and other drug cartel drugs going to the United States as part of that particular network. On a trip financed in part by John Hull, an American from Indiana whose farm in Costa Rica served as a drop site for the CIA, Owen visited Costa Rica, Nicaragua, Honduras, and El Salvador for, quote, 10 days or 2 weeks, unquote, in the summer of 1983. Hull provided Owen an airplane ticket after the congressional aide arranged a series of meetings for Hull to lobby Congress for greater U.S. assistance for the Contras. Owen, age 35, came to national attention last year with his testimony before the Iran-Contra Committee, detailing his role as a secret go-between for then-White House aide Oliver North, the National Security Council staffer who was masterminding the secret effort to provide U.S. assistance to the Contras after Congress outlawed aid in 1984. Vice President George Bush, the Republican presidential nominee, continues to encounter criticism from Democratic rival Michael Dukakis over his own alleged acquiescence to Iran-Contra covert machinations. The links between Quayle and Owen and any ties the GOP vice presidential nominee had with the Reagan administration's Iran-Contra affair are expected to come to light at a press conference by Hull on Tuesday. Skipping down, that would have been last Tuesday. Owen met North while working for the Indiana senator and later, after leaving Quayle's staff in 1983, worked closely with North on secret operations in Central America. Owen, who by mid-1983 had worked for Quayle 18 months, said he took a vacation from his job on Capitol Hill to make the trip in late July and early August of that year. Hull provided a round-trip airline ticket to Costa Rica, Owen said, but Owen paid the additional expenses of expanding the visit to three other countries. Owen was invited to make the trip after he arranged a series of meetings with influential people in Washington for Hull and fellow William Crone, both Americans with property in Costa Rica who were supportive of CIA efforts to assist the rebels' war against the Sandinistas. Working out of Quayle's Senate office, Owen arranged for, quote, different aides from different senators, unquote, to meet with Hull, Crone, also from Indiana, and Contra Commander Luis Rivas, who had just returned from the fighting, according to a deposition filed by Crone in response to a civil suit. The sessions, which Crone said took place in Owen's office, were designed to convince members of Congress that anti-Sandinista forces needed additional U.S. military assistance. Skipping down, Owen also introduced Hull, Crone, and Rivas to North, who then was working at the White House on a number of projects, including preparations for covert assistance to the Contras in case Congress outlawed direct U.S. aid. The group's 15 to 20-minute meeting with North was Owen's first encounter with a White House aide with whom he later became closely involved. Owen said an aide to the National Security Council suggested Owen take the group to see North. Owen said he sought clearance from the Senate Ethics Committee staff for the financial arrangements for his trip, which included accepting the gift of an airline ticket from a private citizen who was lobbying Congress at the time for additional U.S. assistance to the rebels. Quote, "There was nothing, absolutely nothing on my agenda regarding any effort, thought, or concentration of trying to provide any type of support for the Contras," Owen said. "All I was doing was going down and seeing for myself what was happening," unquote. Upon his return to Washington, Owen said he briefed Quayle on his visit. Quayle's aide said Owen did not brief the senator upon his return. Owen said he, quote, "may have called North," after his return to Washington, but it was not until April 1984, 5 months after leaving Quayle's staff, that he sat down with North and talked over the situation in Central America. By then, Owen was working for Gray & Company, a Washington lobbying firm that was considering taking a public relations account to build U.S. support for the Contras. Well, besides some of the obvious things in this article, it should be pointed out these sort of interesting labyrinths of supposed private citizenry that people go into and out of in Washington. Gray & Company, we've talked about in the past. Gray & Company has a long and fascinating history in regards to U.S. secret intelligence operations and various other sorts of machinations.
Notably, Robert Keith Gray, its founder, is connected with, among others, Edwin Wilson. In fact, served on the board of directors of Consultants International, one of the many corporate fronts set up by Edwin Wilson during his many operations.
Indeed. So when you have somebody like Rob Owen and supposedly drawing this this distinction that, well, I left Quayle's staff for 5 months before I went to work for Oliver North, thus obviously trying to put some distance between his involvement with Quayle and his involvement with Oliver North because of Dan Quayle's vulnerable position right now vis-a-vis being a VP candidate. Boy, vis-a-vis being a VP, that's tough. Anyway, again, you have to put it in the context that even if this is true and that there was 5 months between the time he left Quayle's staff and the time he went to work for Oliver North, going to work for Robert Keith Gray's Gray & Company is basically just another hallway in the same sort of secret team underground maze and does not, in fact, signify any break in continuity whatsoever.
One of the key networks, one of the key words here, is networking. A lot of times we've spoken in the past about how people tend to dismiss this type of research as conspiracy theory. If you simply take the same concept and give it a different name, call it networking instead of conspiracy, it's something which I think is a lot more recognizable for people, and I think it helps people get over the bump of the word conspiracy, which has, frankly, a very negative connotation that's been deliberately promoted in our society. The notion of conspiracy immediately conjures up images of propeller beanies, two-way wrist radios, and secret decoder rings. And it basically is the business that goes on all around us. And if you just refer to it as networking, it has a much more recognizable feel to it than conspiracy.
As a matter of fact, on a semantic point, if the Iran-Contra affair, as it's referred to in this article, or as the scandal, as it's referred to in other articles, were only called what, in fact, it was, it would be titled the Iran-Contra conspiracy, because, in fact, when people meet in secret for the express purpose of breaking laws, which is what the entire Iran-Contra mess was about, and again, only the tip of the iceberg, but even just taking the tip of the iceberg, that, in fact, is a conspiracy. That is the legal definition of a conspiracy. So if, in fact, they had called it what it was, conspiracy theory as a concept might be in sort of better odor in the public nostril at this moment. It was the Iran-Contra conspiracy. They chose not to call it that, so again, we will refer to it as networking and refer to what we're doing as networking research, I suppose.
Yeah, but again, it remains to be seen just where Dan Quayle fits into this whole picture. The whole cut of Quayle's political jib, as far as I can tell, is that he appears to be a tool rather than a policymaker, and he has ridden in on the coattails of people more powerful and influential than himself. He certainly was part of the congressional and senatorial Contra support team. To what extent he himself actually had his own fingers in some of this illegal activity, if any, remains to be seen. But it is interesting that Rob Owen should have found his way into this whole morass through his position as an aide to Quayle.
Yes. However, again, as Dave said, we don't know anything specifically too much about Quayle at this point. Let's do remember that he is the scion of a large newspaper family, an extremely wealthy and extremely conservative newspaper family. Dan Quayle's father was a John Bircher. So, again, these are the the kind of people, while Dan Quayle himself may not be an important policymaker in the sense that perhaps a George Bush or somebody else like that might be, Dan Quayle himself is a very important tool for these kinds of people to have, or a very important partner to have in the kind of operations they're involved with.
It's interesting, too, that one of his aides should have been involved with a PR effort on behalf of Noriega. Obviously, Noriega and the Medellin cartel figure in the background of the Contra supply effort and the Iran-Contra scandal as well. The archive shows, for those people who find some of the arguments on the program a little incomprehensible, if, you know, names like Laszlo Pastor or whatever don't ring any immediate bells, we understand that. That's why we put a series of programs together called archive shows, which contain the documentation upon which our arguments are built in this broadcast. The name of the duplication service which stocks our archive shows on permanent basis is Archives on Audio. That's Archives on Audio, P.O. Box 170023, Box 170023. That's in San Francisco, zip code 94117, 94117-0023. Phone number 415-346-1840, 415-346-1840. Write or phone to the attention of Paul. Neither NIP nor myself nor this station makes any money off of this arrangement. This is set up for your information. Again, next week.